Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, you've probably never heard of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. So why do they have so much sway over the laws affecting your life? We may get some sunlight on the actions of this influential public-private membership organization with the release of a cache of previously secret documents on their work. We'll hear from Mary Batari of the Center for Media and Democracy about the ALEC Exposed Project and what it all means. Also on the show, a hunger strike by California prisoners against what they say are torturous and abusive conditions has gotten little national coverage despite the grave charges, which have gained some support from independent experts. We'll talk to Marjorie Cohn, professor at the Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and editor of The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Rupert Murdoch defenders inside the News Corp empire are circling the wagons. The morning show Fox & Friends interviewed PR pro Robert Dillenschneider, who judged that Murdoch had done all the right things and declared it time to move on. Host Steve Doocy agreed, chiding media for not covering more important issues before presenting a performance by the aging boy band Lifehouse. Bill O'Reilly, who called for arrests in the 2008 hacking of Sarah Palin's email, was strangely silent on the more serious crimes, including police bribes and hacking crime victims' phones, now alleged against News Corp employees. Fox's media review show Newswatch made no on-air mention of the scandal, but video of panelists chuckling during commercial breaks about how they couldn't talk about it made it to the web, awkwardly enough. Then there was News Corp's Wall Street Journal, whose editor suggested critics were undermining freedom of the press, equated News Corp's alleged criminal activity to other outlets buying scoops and digging dirt, and asked, quote, "Do our media brethren really want to invite Congress and prosecutors to regulate how journalists gather the news?" Close quote. The short answer for many when criminal activity is involved, yes. One defense from outside the empire came from USA Today founder Al Newharth, who used his column to argue that Murdoch just gives people what they want and claimed, strangely, that Murdoch founded Fox News in 1996, quote, to counter the left-wing MSNBC, close quote. In fact, in those early years, MSNBC leaned rightward, featuring the likes of Laura Ingraham, Oliver North, and Ann Coulter. MSNBC didn't begin assembling its current liberal evening lineup until 2003, when Keith Olbermann was hired.
Eric Bolling, Fox News' replacement for Glenn Beck in the 5 p.m. time slot, wasted no time establishing that he can rewrite history as well as Beck ever could, and be unapologetic and thin-skinned, too. On July 12th, Bolling declared, quote, "America was certainly safe between 2000 and 2008. I don't remember any attacks on American soil during that period of time," close quote. Bolling's case of Bush-boosting amnesia is not his alone. It's a conservative malady we've talked about here, in which right-wingers' terrorism timelines mysteriously exclude September 11th, 2001. It wasn't challenged by Bolling's guests, one of whom was Bush White House Press Secretary Dana Perino, herself on the record telling Sean Hannity, quote, "We did not have a terrorist attack on our country during President Bush's term," close quote. It's no surprise, really, that when his mistake was noted by Media Matters and the Huffington Post, the ambitious Bolling saw a chance to denounce the radical liberal left for a low blow, claiming on his show days later that he happened to be standing there when the towers fell and had lost friends in the attack, which, to some, only makes it weirder that he would forget it. But he didn't forget, Bolling says. He misspoke. He meant to say that there were no U.S. terror attacks in the Bush years after 9/11. That's also false, as those years included the anthrax attacks, the Beltway sniper, the El Al ticket counter incident, and several others. One Bush-era terrorist who killed two people at a progressive church in Knoxville actually cited as his inspiration one of Bolling's colleagues, Fox News contributor Bernard Goldberg. In Bolling's world, though, remembering history as it actually happened is not only a thought crime, it's impolite.
USA Today published a useful investigation on July 15th, finding that rates of violent crime along the U.S.-Mexico border have been falling for years, that U.S. border cities are statistically safer on average than other cities in their states, and that, quote, border cities, big and small, have maintained lower crime rates than the national average, which itself has been falling, close quote. The paper's investigation dispels what it calls the bloody pictures of the U.S. border with Mexico. But while it cites politicians like Arizona Governor Jan Brewer for spreading the myth, the piece lets national right-wing commentators off the hook. It's folks like Fox's Bill O'Reilly who, as Fair has repeatedly noted, have been pushing the border violence lie for some time. O'Reilly suggested in just one example that Arizona was bankrupt because crime's through the roof, with undocumented immigration the obvious culprit. O'Reilly's then-Fox colleague Glenn Beck described the situation, quote, America's border crisis, rape, drugs, kidnapping, even murder, close quote. Mainstream media, too, have fed the myth. So while USA Today's investigation is not the first to debunk border violence hysteria with such prominent voices intent to encourage it, it's helpful to have more evidence to counter the falsehoods.
You could say the New York Times ignored the protests at Major League Baseball's All-Star Game held in Phoenix, Arizona, protests targeting the anti-immigrant Arizona law known as SB 1070. But the Times' July 13th article by Karen Krause did more than that. It made a story out of protesters' non-existence. Krause starts off with the claim that a fan yelling at the Diamondback mascot to beat L.A. was the loudest grievance heard all day, because predicted protests didn't happen. She writes that there had been talk of demonstrators passing out white ribbons to protest the law. But hours before the game, quote, the white accessory sported by seemingly every other fan filing into the stadium was a hotel chain's promotional tea towel, close quote. How odd, then, that the same day's AP story reports a group of protesters, quote, quietly passing out white ribbons that symbolized peace and unity, close quote. The AP's Amanda Lee Myers also saw a group of people chanting into bullhorns and marching with signs reading, boycott hate and stand with us. Demonstrators also evidently visible to the reporter from the Arizona Republic. Nope, says the Times. Quote, the sign of the Times was not carried by any protester. It was a billboard 1.5 miles from the stadium that offered personal loans for people with unexpected bills, close quote. And again, if you missed the theme, interest in immigration law was as flat as a half-full can of soda left in the 100-degree heat because times are hard and, quote, the sold-out game was a welcome sight, like a rainbow after a devastating storm, close quote. Once more, before the story ends, the Times' Krause states that, quote, one could find protesters, but they were not taking up the cause of illegal immigration, close quote. This, not because few are found who take up the cause of illegal immigration, but because she spotted members of the Carpenters Union leafleting a bank for unfair labor practices. So for those actually at the event, I guess the question of whether there were protests at the game comes down to whether you believe the Times or your lying eyes.
And finally, the war in Afghanistan is now the longest in U.S. history, with a vital, independent press corps reporting on the region might have evolved immeasurably by now, and the U.S. public's understanding of Afghan history and culture been enriched. What elite U.S. media actually offer are articles like one in the Wall Street Journal on July 14th about a new report on Afghan deaths. The report cited night raids as being particularly contentious. Quote, the raids are sensitive in Afghanistan because foreign soldiers burst into civilian homes where strangers are unwelcome in the country's conservative Islamic traditions, close quote. Oh, those conservative Islamic traditions.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Not a lobby or a front group, the American Legislative Exchange Council is one of the most politically influential organizations you've likely never heard of. Hopefully that's changing now with the release of documents covering decades of the group's work, which happens to include drafting the laws you and I live by. So who's in ALEC and how do they work? And who's watching them? Joining us now to shed light on the subject is Mary Batari. She's director of the Real Economy Project at the Center for Media and Democracy, the home of the new project, ALEC Exposed. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mary Batari.
Thank you for having us.
So what is ALEC and what do they do?
ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they were created back in the 70s. At the time when all these right-wing institutions were being created, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Moral Majority, and ALEC's piece of that pie was to create extremely conservative right-wing model bills that would then be introduced to legislatures across the country. So it's a partnership between right-wing politicians and corporations to craft these bills behind closed doors. Corporations actually get a vote on these bills behind closed doors before they are ever introduced in state houses across the land and before people get a chance to see the proposal and, you know, democratically debate it.
What are the kind of philosophical origins, if you will, behind ALEC? Once you look into them, the agenda is pretty clear.
ALEC was founded by the losers of the 60s and the 70s, right? It was founded by folks who were really upset about the Clean Water Act and really upset about the Clean Air Act and dangerous trend of unions springing up all over the place and state unions of public employees springing up. OSHA was created during this time period, and so was the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So these folks thought government was running amok, and it's one of their primary agenda items has been to shrink government. And so they have dozens and dozens of bills in the ALEC Exposed archive that make it much harder for government to function, for government to exist. And they also, you know, for those more lucrative areas of government, they also want to privatize all those services. They want to sell off bridges and toll roads and those kinds of things. And they want to privatize social services, foster care, pensions, Medicare, Medicaid, you name it.
Well, I should note that Fares Magazine Extra had a piece by Bo Hodai, who's done a lot of work on ALEC, in May 2010. And that was about the group's efforts to fight municipal broadband. So you really can't overemphasize they are into everything.
They are into everything. And that broadband article was a good one because that type of agenda item has long been one of their priorities. They have a sort of telecommunications task force that works on these things. And they have task forces in dozens of other areas. So the most famous ALEC bills recently have been these voter ID bills that are passing in state by state, these anti-immigration bills to bust unions and defund unions. These are the more famous ALEC specials that have been coming out recently.
What this group does then is draft this model legislation that then appears as kind of cookie cutter laws around the country, and yet they're a 501c3?
It's kind of interesting. They don't think any lobbying is going on because ALEC itself does not lobby.
Uh-huh.
But 20 of its 24 corporate board members are lobbyists. And then there's legislative board members, too, and they sit down together, and the corporations hand the legislators the law changes they desire, and the legislators themselves sort of become super lobbyists. They go back to their state. They introduce these measures. It's actually the duty of the state chairman for each state to introduce these measures, and they promote ALEC's agenda without anyone in the public knowing anything about it.
All right, well, let's move on to ALEC Exposed. What is the nature of the documents that have been released recently or obtained?
So many of these bills have been seen across the country because they've been introduced in state legislatures. But now we have over 800 of the bills displayed on alecexposed.org. So citizens and citizen journalists can go and find some measure that they've been battling in their state. For instance, today I came across an ALEC bill that would ban local initiatives on GMOs or pesticides. So when localities want to regulate pesticide usage or GMOs at the local level, ALEC is against that kind of thing. So you can find a particular measure that's been really irking you in your state. Maybe it's a healthcare measure, maybe it's an environmental measure, maybe it's a taxation issue. and you might be able to find it on the ALEC Exposed website.
You mentioned citizen journalists, but what about big media, so-called? There's been pickup already. It seems like a treasure trove of stories for reporters on a range of subjects in a range of regions. What are your hopes for what journalists will do with it?
Well, what we really need is we need someone from each state, and hopefully a major newspaper from each state or a media outlet, to create a report for their state that identifies all the ALEC bills. We just think it's important to unveil the forces behind these bills and how they're popping up all over and give a sort of detailed analysis. We have done that for Wisconsin. So if you go to alecexposed.org, you'll see a list of 20 Wisconsin bills, but that needs to be done state by state by state.
So it's not, in other words, that the legislation is on its face terrible in every case. That's not what it's about. It's about showing people how it got made, who was behind it, so that there can be some sunlight on the process.
If we're going to have a functional democracy, we cannot allow corporations to go behind closed doors and rewrite our laws. These bills have to be exposed, and that has to be done state by state, and we're going to need a lot of help to do it. And also on our alecexposed.org website, you can see a list of the politicians that we know of in each state. You can see a list of the corporations involved, but both those lists are incomplete. So we'd also like citizen help in identifying the ALEC legislators in their states and adding to our list.
We've been speaking with Mary Batari of the Center for Media and Democracy's Real Economy Project. Learn more at alecexposed.org. Thanks again, Mary Batari, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
A hunger strike by California prisoners protesting what they claim are abusive and torturous conditions for many prisoners held in special detention has been underway since July 1st. Despite the serious charges, which have gained the support of independent experts, the story has received little coverage. Only a small fraction, for instance, of the coverage given to a story alleging that some prisoners in U.S. prisons possess illegal cell phones. Joining us now to talk about the coverage of prisoner issues is Marjorie Cohn, a professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School and the past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her column about the hunger strike can be found at the Monthly Review website and commondreams.org. She joins us now by phone from California. Welcome back to Counterspin, Marjorie Cohn.
My pleasure, Steve.
Marjorie, fill us in on some of the details on why the prisoners are striking.
Well, there have been more than 6,000 prisoners across California who have been refusing food in solidarity with prisoners at California's Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax prison, and specifically the Security Housing Unit, where prisoners have been held for years, 25, 30, 40 years, in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement constitutes torture, as Lance Tapley, a journalist, explains in his chapter on the supermax prisons in my book, The United States and Torture. And the demands that the prisoners are striking over, in addition to the end of long-term solitary confinement, is to end the use of group punishment and abolish a policy called debriefing, where the prisoners are, in order to get out of solitary confinement, they're forced to name themselves or others as gang members or leaders. And naming other people as gang members itself amounts to a death sentence due to retaliation by other prisoners. There are other demands as well, granting access to adequate health care and sunlight, adequate food, a demand to stop using food as a tool to punish inmates, etc.
Well, I've read that since this sort of special detention is not applied as punishment, but for administrative reasons, that it doesn't come under the sort of review that it might otherwise.
Well, the Supreme Court has said that under the Eighth Amendment, in order to constitute cruel and unusual punishment, it has to actually be some kind of punishment. But by renaming it administrative convenience, they try to get around the Eighth Amendment. But keep in mind that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in May, actually upheld a lower court ruling, that incarceration in California's prisons constitute unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual punishment because of the conditions of confinement. So I think that's very significant. And in addition, the United States has ratified the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, which includes not just punishment in the strict sense, but also treatment as well.
In your column about the strike, which can be found on Counterpunch and Common Dreams, you cite some independent experts who back up the prisoners' charges. For instance, and there's some other elements here too, in some cases they're exposed to 24 hours of dim light or 24 hours of bright light. Tell us what this can lead to, according to some of the experts who have looked at the conditions.
Well, when you have somebody in solitary confinement, that can lead to hallucinations, catatonic state, and even suicide, particularly in mentally ill prisoners. And this is one of the things that Lance Tapley mentions in his chapter on supermax prisons in the United States and torture. He talks about solitary confinement and in the supermax prisons, not just in California, but around the country, and how particularly in mentally ill patients, it can lead to suicide, but also it can create mental illness as well. Keeping lights on day and night, keeping people in these small spaces, has also been called, if not torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which also violates the Convention Against Torture. And I should say that that is a treaty the United States has ratified, and when the U.S. ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution.
If I had to typify the little coverage that has appeared, I'd say that while some tried to get the story, a Los Angeles Times story reported on how media access to the prisoners was being blocked, many reports declined to include expert opinion on the prison conditions that you found easy to find. There was also much commentary that suggested that we need not worry about prisoners who have, after all, committed crimes. One especially harsh example was a Creator Syndicate column by Susan Estrich, in which she said the idea of prisoners on a hunger strike made her laugh. Is it this attitude that, after all, they have committed crimes that accounts for such generally poor coverage of prisoner and prison issues, do you think?
I think so. I think that prisoners are considered the worst of the worst, and because of the media coverage, we'll think, like Susan Estrich, she wrote, a hunger strike by prison gang members to get better conditions, drinking only water until they get better food. Could I make this up? She says she had to struggle not to start laughing. First of all, these are not, by and large, gang members, and even if they were, it does not allow them to be treated cruelly. Remember that Dostoevsky said that the degree of civilization in a society can be measured by entering its prisons. And just because people have committed crimes does not mean that they do not have the right to be treated humanely. The San Francisco Chronicle ran an article on July 8th, which was pretty good. They could have cited expert opinions and more detail about what was happening in the prisons, the conditions, the demands, and the effects of the mistreatment. But on the 14th of July, the San Francisco Chronicle ran a story that the headline was California Sees Gang Ties. They talked about in the article, since there was communication between prisons and prisoners in other prisons were striking in solidarity with the Pelican Bay prisoners, that must have been on the order of gang members. That allegation was refuted in the article by strike supporters, but the headline made it look like, oh, we're just talking about gangs and kind of dismissing it. I thought that one of the best, most comprehensive articles was actually in, of all places, Al Jazeera. And that's where I got the quote from the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons, which is headed by a former U.S. Attorney General and a former Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals, who talked about torture as conditions. And it was a very telling article. Most of the TV coverage has been not network TV, but local TV, such as in Sacramento. And there have been some articles in California newspapers, a couple in national newspapers. The New York Times ran what I think was a very good op-ed on the 18th by Colin Diane, a professor of English at Vanderbilt, who tied the hunger strike to what was happening at Guantanamo and also the new Supreme Court ruling from May. But this was an op-ed. It was not in the news section, and so it's his opinion. I would like to see more hard news coverage in some of the major national newspapers. This is a very, very big story. You have people here who are dying, literally dying, and in solidarity with people in other prisons. There was a press release from the Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity Committee, which said some strikers are in renal failure. Some are having measured blood sugars in the 30 range, which can be fatal if not treated. These are the kinds of details that need to get out into the public realm.
As I mentioned, the Los Angeles Times had a hard time getting access to prisoners. In fact, they were denied access to prisoners. Isn't access to the incarcerated a free speech, free press issue?
Well, it's also the law under the Geneva Conventions. The Red Cross, International Committee of the Red Cross, has a right to access to all prisoners in U.S. custody. And the Bush administration was notorious for hiding prisoners. They were called ghost detainees. When the UN tried to get a treaty signed by many countries to allow independent monitors to come in and look at prisons in different countries, the United States didn't sign that treaty, didn't ratify it, because we don't want outside independent experts looking at our prisons. And you wonder, what do we have to hide?
We've been speaking with Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. You can read her column on the prison hunger strike online at Common Dreams. Cohen is also the editor of the new book, The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Marjorie Cohn.
My pleasure, Steve and Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.